From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. China is moving to tighten its grip on the world's oil supplies. Last week, the China National Offshore Oil Corporation, a state-owned company, bid $18.5 billion for the U.S. oil company Unocal. China's goal, to make sure it has enough oil to keep its economy racing forward. Energy policy is transforming China's foreign policy. China has already reached out to Latin America, Central Asia, Africa, and Russia. And that makes many people very nervous that China will cozy up to rogue states like Iran and the Sudan to keep the taps open, undermining U.S. diplomatic efforts. That U.S. oil companies will fly the flag of a communist regime. And that competition will keep oil prices sky high. Today, they already reached record levels of more than $60 a barrel. Tonight on Point, the bid for Unocal and what China's big push for oil will mean for the U.S. economy and U.S. national security. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you concerned about this? Does a state-owned Chinese company bid for an American oil company pose a security threat, a geopolitical threat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Washington is Kenneth Lieberthal, professor of business administration and professor of political science at the University of Michigan, and a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. He is former senior director for Asia at the National Security Council and special assistant to the president for national security affairs, and also the author of Governing China from Revolution Through Reform. Welcome, Kenneth Lieberthal.
Good evening.
And also with me from Washington is Gal Luft, the executive director of the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, whose advisors include former CIA director James Woolsey. Luft is also a publisher of the online publication Energy Security. Gal, welcome to you.
Good evening.
Thanks to have you with the program. Thanks for being with us on the program. Gal, let me start with you. Is this an offer that just came out of nowhere, or did this come as no surprise to you and people who've been following this closely?
Well, the Chinese have had an interest in Unocal for a number of weeks, perhaps even a month. There was another rumor about an offer that a couple months ago. It went already, it was about $13 billion, I believe. But this one came almost as a surprise. The $18.5 billion is something that took many by surprise.
And Kenneth Lieberthal, what can you tell us about, I can't really read this over and over and over again, but the name of the Chinese company, let me find it here, the China National Offshore Oil Corporation, is shortened in newspaper accounts to CNOOC. First of all, tell us how to pronounce that.
It's generally pronounced CNOOC.
CNOOC, okay. And what can you tell us about CNOOC as a company?
It was the first company to get engaged in offshore oil exploration for China, founded back in 1982. It's really evolved a great deal over the years. There's still majority government ownership of the company, but the company has non-Chinese outside directors. It actually uses English as its operating language. It's audited by Pricewaterhouse. It's listed on the New York Stock Exchange. So it is not... It doesn't fit the kind of image of a Chinese state-owned conservative communist behemoth. It, in fact, is a quite competitive, international-minded, and in many ways internationalized company that has a lot of state ownership in China. In fact, a lot of its senior staff are people who are foreign staff hired from other oil companies around the world.
And so how do you see this bid for Unocal in the larger context of perhaps what we could call China Incorporated?
Well, the Chinese are not only energy short, but short in most kinds of natural resources on a per capita basis. We've known about that for a long time, but it's only recently that their economy has grown to a size where those per capita shortages are really having a tremendous impact on China's economic strategy. And in oil and other kinds of energy and also in a wide array of mineral resources, China is suddenly emerging as a major resource importer. We see part of China's strategy followed in the last few years to go abroad and seek equity stakes in resource bases. In other words, rather than simply buying oil on the spot market or through long-term contracts or whatever, taking what's available out on the market, they are also, where they can, actually investing in oil reserves abroad. And the same is true of natural gas. By the way, the same is true of iron ore and other kinds of minerals. I think that reflects some distrust of the international markets and certainly a deep-seated feeling of insecurity and a desire to assure their capacity to access critical materials for their continued economic growth.
And Gal Luft, how do you see this? Is this something, is this a cause for concern, or is this simply inevitable as China continues growing in the 21st century?
Well, China will grow into the 21st century, no doubt about that. This whole thing comes in conjunction to the growth of another very large country, India, also 1 billion people. The two of them grow at a very fast pace, and they need a lot of energy. If you opened your Christmas gift, you see that everything is produced in China nowadays. We want them to produce everything for us, and that requires a lot of energy as well. You have a lot of people moving from bicycles to passenger cars. They need gasoline. China is doing everything it can to acquire those energy resources. And the question is how much cheaply available oil is out there. I think this is what will determine more than anything how this resource is going to be managed. Some people believe that we are approaching a moment in history in which we have exhausted the majority of the cheaply available oil, and at that point, the price of oil never goes down, and there is a more and more tightness in the market. If we are indeed facing a situation like that, that means that the United States and China will have to compete over the same sandbox, and from time to time they will have to step on each other's toes. And that will definitely have an impact on U.S.-China relations.
Well, and also, this Chinese company faces a chicken or egg problem, right, in that it needs to get the approval of the U.S. government for this deal, but it first needs to have the deal in hand, and Chevron, which has also put in a bid for Unocal, is probably saying, whoa, not so fast here.
Right.
you're right in saying that, and let's keep in mind that Chevron does have a bid into Unocal, which is standing there, which will be voted on, I believe, by Unocal's current shareholders. And as they vote on that, it's voting about is voting either for a bird in the hand at $16+ billion bid, or for a bird in the bush at $18+ billion. But the bird in the bush conceivably will not materialize. Because the Chinese bid, A, could be taken off the table. That's unlikely, but the Chinese are not obligated to follow through on their bid should the shareholders turn down the Chevron bid, and B, because of the regulatory concerns that you just mentioned. So it is very possible that the current Unocal shareholders will, in fact, opt to accept the Chevron bid, and the Chinese bid will go by the boards.
But the Chinese company clearly is doing everything it can to try to ease security concerns in the U.S. Kenneth Lieberthal, you were giving us the list a moment ago of some of the people who it has brought into this deal. Would they not be enough to prevail to say, listen, you really don't have to worry about security here?
Well, first of all, we do have laws that govern this, and we have a committee on foreign investment in the United States that is tasked with reviewing foreign investments that raise enough government concern that this committee is asked to review them. And I think there's no question at all that the CNOOC bid will go through that committee, and CNOOC, in fact, has itself preempted by calling for a regulatory review. It's kind of calling for something that you know that you can't avoid anyway. I think that in other times, this bid would probably have an easier time going through than it will in the coming few months. There is a lot of concern that's been raised in the Congress, especially about the Chinese peg of its currency to the U.S. dollar, which it has argued in the Hill, up on the Hill, is costing U.S. jobs and eroding the U.S. manufacturing base, about IPR, intellectual property rights violations by Chinese firms. We're about to see a report come out from the Pentagon that will call attention to Chinese recent Chinese trends in military development. There are a lot of things out there now, and also Chinese successful bid for the PC and ThinkPad part of the IBM business by a Chinese firm called Lenovo, and a just announced bid not by any means yet successfully completed for Maytag. So I think in the context of all these other things going on, the political pressure to take a very, very tough view in scrutinizing the current bid will certainly be there. Whether the Chinese will prevail or not, we'll just have to see how this plays out.
Gal Luft, we have just a few seconds before we go to the break, but what's your best guess as to how it would play out on Capitol Hill?
I think that it all depends on what kind of decision will be taken at the boardrooms and not at, in Capitol Hill. I think that there'll be probably going to be very little ground to block a bid like this using legal means. But I think that we need to look at this issue in the broader context of the competitiveness of American companies rather than focus on the Unocal as a company itself. I think that the much bigger things are at stake here, and Unocal should be a sort of a case study or a wake-up call for us to decide what kind of energy policy we want to see, what kind of a trade policy we want to see. And I think these are questions we need to deal with.
Well, many big issues here. We're going to deal with them after we take a break. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about a state-owned Chinese oil company's bid for Unocal and what China's search for secure sources of oil means for the U.S. economy and U.S. national security. We invite you to join the conversation. What, if anything, can the U.S. do to avoid a tug of war with China over oil supplies in the Middle East? Is this so different from a Chinese company buying, say, IBM's PC business or Maytag? And if so, why? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I want to go to China now for some reaction to this takeover bid. Matt Pottinger has been covering the story from Beijing for the Wall Street Journal, and he joins me on the line now from Beijing. Matt, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Good evening to you.
Tell me first, what has been the reaction there?
Well, it's pretty interesting. I mean, it is. It hasn't stirred up the kind of political furor, obviously, or attention here that it has in the United States. But people are paying attention here. There has been a fair amount of media coverage, and I think that really Chinese companies and the Chinese public generally are viewing this this bid and its eventual outcome as some kind of a clarifying experience. People are aware of the politics involved in the United States and have a sense that if this bid is eventually tripped up by political considerations in the United States, that's going to inform people how to really expect relations to go with the United States on matters of trade as well as energy security.
Well, on those points, we got to hear a little earlier in the program from Kenneth Lieberthal and Gal Luft, who are also standing by. But as you look around in Beijing, what do you see? What is obvious in terms of what's driving China's growing thirst for oil?
Well, I mean, for starters, an incredible amount of conspicuous consumption here. You're actually starting to see Humvees even on the streets of Beijing. Although what's really driving their thirst for energy is not yet automobiles. China has only a couple million cars on the road. What's driving it much more than that is production. I mean, the means of production for everything that we buy on Walmart shelves in the United States, all the plastics, everything from carpet into the polyurethane vinyl that goes into shoes. That is, at the end of the day, stuff that is based on oil, and that is what's driving China's desire to secure, it's insecurity, a sense of insecurity over its ability to continue accessing supplies of cheap oil.
And also, from what I've been reading here, a tremendous need to keep the engines running in the power plants, keep the electricity on.
Yeah, I mean, power plants is part of it as well. China is about 75% of their power actually comes from coal, and oil is not a major contributor to traditionally to their power consumption. But what's happened is that the economy here has grown so fast that it really took the central planners by surprise, and there have been power shortages over the past couple of years. So when you have power shortages, what factories do is they buy diesel generators, and you've actually seen a spike in oil demand based on these power shortages and the need for gassing up these generators in the backs of factories. So that's a factor that eventually will be eased because they're building so many new power plants right now. But the overall trend is still an upward arc in oil demand in this country.
Matt, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Matt Pottinger is staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Beijing. Back to Kenneth Lieberthal and Gal Luff now. Gal, I want to ask something you wrote about how Japan's need for oil led it into World War 67 years ago. Is that part of what gives you pause now as you see this bid from China?
Well, history, it's actually a very appropriate time to raise this because this summer we'll commemorate the anniversary of the atom bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we need to remind ourselves why and how this whole ordeal started. Japan was completely dependent on the United States and completely dependent on foreign oil, and that brought about a policy of expansionism and aggressive policy, and that really brought about eventually to the attack on Pearl Harbor. We have seen throughout history that oil and natural resources have been a major driver in countries' decisions to go to war, foreign policy, etc. And I think that if we look at China, we've seen that in the past 10 years, China really moved from being a net oil exporter to a point that it is the second largest consumer in the world. And we need to begin to think, how do we carry this 10 or 20 years forward? What do we have to deal with in an environment that is not even clear how much oil there is out there? And considering the fact that it also takes decades to shift our economy from oil to alternative sources of energy. And these are strategic questions that needs to be addressed not only by the United States, but also by all the major consuming countries. And China is one of them.
Kenneth Lieberthal, do you find some potential here of history repeating itself, or is that too dark a view?
I think in any mechanical reading of history is too dark a view. The military reality out there that the Chinese understand as well as we do is that almost all oil consumed by China and the United States, I shouldn't say almost all, but a cripplingly large percentage of oil consumed by each country has to travel a very long distance to get into our own economies, and it is highly vulnerable while it is being transported. Modern military power projection capabilities are such that you cannot expect to fight a war and protect your energy supplies at the same time if you're depending on oil resources from the Middle East or from Indonesia or from Africa or from Latin America. And so I think that the more recent Japanese experience is more instructive. Japan, since World War II, has continued to be a tremendous energy importer. In fact, it was the second largest in the world until China took over that slot just last year. But no one thinks of Japan as fighting with any other country militarily for access to energy supplies. I think all countries are concerned about energy security, naturally. But I think there's an underlying awareness now that this is a world where cooperation among consumers is very important. It's indicative, for example, that many of the reserves that CNOOC is seeking to buy by obtaining control, you know, by taking over Unocal, are in fact natural gas fields in the Gulf of Siam and in Indonesia. And for a good portion of those reserves, Chevron, among others, also owns them. In other words, they try and have 100% of those fields. It has partial control, shares it with others, and has to cooperate with others. So this is a more complicated world now than I think, you know, a kind of mechanical reading of past conflict over access to resources would suggest.
I want to go to our phone lines now. We've got from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Alan is on the line. Welcome to the program, Alan.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. What would you like to add?
Well, my point is that this Unocal deal, I doubt will go through due to, you know, certain considerations. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. There'll be many more deals like this that will go through. And China's the mortgagee, and we're the mortgagor, along with most of South and Central America. They're going to buy up everything from the tip of South America all the way up through Canada, and they won't need to take over militarily. It'll gradually be more immigrants and more immigrants, and with the way it's turning, they're going to own everything unless we do radical restructuring of our economic model here of how we do business. We can't just continually run $200 billion trade deficits for these people. They're going to own everything.
Alan, thanks for the call. And to that point, I want to bring in another voice to this conversation. Patrick Malloy is joining us from Alexandria, Virginia. He's a member of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, which looks at the national security implications of trade with China. He's also a professor of international trade law at Catholic University and George Mason University Law Schools, and former Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Market Access and Compliance, and former General Counsel for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee. Patrick Malloy, welcome.
I'm delighted to be with you, and thank you for inviting me to join in.
Well, it's a pleasure. I wonder if you'd speak to Alan's point.
Well, I thought that was an excellent point, and it really echoes what Warren Buffett had to say about this transaction. Warren Buffett's quoted as saying, "If we're going to consume more than we produce, we have to expect to give a little part of the country away." So, when you're running massive current account deficits like the United States is running, and our trade deficit with China is a good portion of that. Our overall deficit is probably about $650 billion. China's about probably not about $170 billion of that. You have to sell off assets and you have to borrow in order to finance that overconsumption. And we've gotten ourselves into this situation. The Chinese, I thought it was very interesting. Dr. Lieberthal talked about China's economic strategy. And they clearly do have an economic strategy. I think keeping the exchange rate the way it is, you know, having the dollar overvalued is part of that economic strategy to cause American companies to move technology, R&D, and other things to China. Now, if I were them, I would be doing the same thing. But they have an economic strategy, and we have none. And you can see the consequences of what is going on when this kind of event just highlights the kind of situation the United States has now gotten itself into.
Kenneth Lieberthal, does it make a difference if China is buying part of IBM or Maytag, now Unocal? Does it make a difference if it's an oil company versus one of these other kinds of companies?
In a lot of technical ways, it does. But in terms of threat to the United States or implications for America's future, I personally don't think that it makes a very big difference. What China is seeking from Unocal, for example, is overwhelmingly Unocal's reserves in Southeast Asia, most of which would have produced for the market to be sold to China in any case. And China has, CNOOC has indicated quite clearly that the American production from Unocal, they will sell off to the highest bidder or sell into the U.S. market. They probably will divest it, actually. So I don't think that that is a crucial difference, actually.
Galluft, what about you? Do you think the U.S. may be sowing the seeds of its own destruction somehow by allowing Chinese investment in American companies to this extent?
Well, wait a minute. Can I jump in just one second? I want to give Gal full opportunity to answer that. But you asked me a different question, which was about, is there a difference between an energy company and other companies? It's worth keeping in mind, as China moves into the Maytags and IBMs of this world, many people, I think, have the image of the Japanese companies coming in the 1980s based on protecting their domestic market, making tremendous profits there, using that money to then buy into strategic positions in the U.S. Many of those investments came a cropper, but the point I want to make is Chinese companies are coming in for very, very different reasons. Their market is generally remarkably open for a continental-sized economy. Their domestic companies are making almost no money domestically, and they're going abroad because that's the only place where they stand a chance of making profits and also of learning how to work in a real market economy. So they're generally fairly weak players going abroad. And my guess is a lot of these investments will turn out to be not highly successful. But I'm sorry, I should let Gail pick up your question.
From a pure energy security standpoint, I think it is important that China is buying Western Hemispheric energy assets, even though it's true that Unocal is most of its assets are not in the Western Hemisphere. But that's why I don't want to dwell too much on Unocal. I think we need to look at it in the broader context of what China is doing in the Western Hemisphere. China has been very engaged in acquiring assets in Canada, in Venezuela, in other Latin American countries. And here is the problem. We import 50% of our oil imports come from the Western Hemisphere. At a time that every politician is saying that we need to reduce our dependence on Middle East oil. The problem is that now we have a partner in the Western Hemisphere, somebody that is vying for the same oil. That means that for every barrel of oil that goes from the Western Hemisphere to China, it's one less barrel that we can get from this hemisphere. That means that we have to look for this oil elsewhere. Now, where can we go? We can go to the Middle East, we can go to the Caspian, we can go to West Africa. These are all unstable areas. They're more remote, they're more difficult to deal with. So I think that the important thing to remember is that China's move into the Western Hemisphere in terms of energy will make us more dependent on countries that, in the words of the president, don't particularly like us.
Let me put that question as well to Patrick Malloy. You know, how do you see this playing in terms of politics, particularly in terms of Canada and Venezuela? You know, certainly now China can provide some competition to the U.S., which has been accused in the past of taking them for granted.
I think you have to, let me just focus on two things. This transaction, let's just focus on this one. This is a Chinese government-controlled oil company buying a privately owned American oil company. Thank goodness that in 1988 the Congress passed the legislation, and I was involved with that. It was in the 88 trade bill, setting up the CFIUS process, where there's an interagency process to review these transactions and make a judgment as to whether they're in the national security interest of the United States. Now, one of the problems, of course, is that committee is chaired by Treasury. In the time that law has been on the books, there have been 1,500 transactions which have been noticed. Treasury has blocked one. So you can see that they don't radically use this. I think there's a need for congressional oversight on how that legislation is being implemented. So that's one thing, and I'm glad that that law is in place. And I'm not saying that this should not go through, but I do think it needs a thorough look. Because everybody's saying that there was a guy, Sebastian Mallaby, in the Washington Post today, said anybody who talks against this is a protectionist. I don't think we need those kinds of terms. We need a thorough look and understanding of what the implications of this are. What technologies does Unocal control that may be important for looking at ocean depths and other things? I don't know, but I think we need a thorough look at it.
Well, we're going to continue we hope will be a thorough look at it after we take a break. We're talking this hour about a state-owned Chinese oil company's $18.5 billion bid for the U.S. oil company Unocal, and what China's growing appetite for oil will mean for the U.S. economy and national security. We invite you to join the conversation. Would you get your gas at a Unocal station if it were owned by the Chinese government? Or would you just drive by? Are you worried that China could tie up major oil supplies and leave the U.S. out in the cold? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking tonight about a state-owned Chinese oil company's $18.5 billion bid for oil company Unocal and what China's growing appetite for oil could mean for the U.S. economy and national security. We invite you to join the conversation. If Chinese companies begin buying U.S. oil companies, where will the U.S. have to go to get its oil supplies? And what, if anything, can the United States do to avoid a tug of war with China over oil supplies from the Middle East? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking this hour with Kenneth Lieberthal, Professor of Business Administration and Professor of Political Science at the University of Michigan. He's also a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. And with Gal Luft, Executive Director of the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security. And with Patrick Malloy, who is a member of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, which looks at the national security implications of trade with China. I want to go back to our phone lines for a moment from Dane County, Wisconsin. Jim is joining us. Hello, Jim, and welcome to the program.
Yes, good evening to you all. As a sidebar, it seems ironic that the country that leads the fight for opening up economies, and even in this day and age where the G8 are forgiving the poorest countries their debt as long as they open up their economies, and here, kind of ironically, we seem to have a little reticence about Chinese coming into this market. But that's just peanuts compared to Unocal. The Chinese are developing the Yard of Iran field in the Caspian, which is part of Iran. And this is on the order of $100 to $200 billion. They're in Kazakhstan, they're in Sudan. And the problematic thing here is that their capital investment in Iran violates the so-called Iran-Libya Sanctions Act, which is going to cause a lot of friction. And even the U.S. has told India, another country, which is a little more reticent than China, that it should not be building a pipeline from Iran to get its oil. I mean, these countries have to satiate their needs, which are voracious. And it's kind of even more ironic that we outsource our jobs to China, lay off many people in this country, make money for corporations, and then how is China supposed to make these cheap widgets?
Jim, thank you for the phone call. Let me put that to Patrick Malloy first.
Well, first off, China's not just making cheap widgets. The United States is running a $45 billion current account trade deficit with China in advanced technology products. So don't think it's just T-shirts and tennis shoes. These are high-tech things that we're beginning to run trade deficits with China in. Now, again, I'm not out to demonize the Chinese, but they have a strategy, and we have none. And the reason I think this strikes home to many Americans, it raises the issue of where are these assets that the Chinese are using now to purchase U.S. companies. We see Maytag, we saw IBM. There's going to be a lot more of these things. Now, what if they decide, well, we can buy GM? You know, GM's a troubled company right now. Do people think that's fine? At some point, you begin to say, what is the economic policy of this country, and do we want to continue to run ever-increasing current account deficits? We're moving toward a current account deficit next year of about $1 trillion a year. Everybody said it's unsustainable. Everybody now sees the trends and where they're going. It just seems to me that the United States really has to make some major changes in the way it's behaving.
Gal Luft, let me put that one to you. It's an interesting question. What if China were to say, sure, we'll buy GM?
Well, I don't think that they need to say, we'll buy GM. I think that all they need to do is to begin to produce $5,000 cars and sell them at Walmart. And, you know, Detroit will be decimated. And I'm not so sure that they are very far away from this. Only yesterday in the New York Times, there was an article about 50,000 first cars that are going to be sold outside of China. And they are gradually closing the quality gap. So I think that this is definitely something that we, again, Detroit needs to look at very carefully. Apropos trade deficit, you know, it's almost interesting that people talk about trade deficit in the context of China, but one full quarter of our trade deficit is due to our oil imports. We are sending $60 per barrel today, and we import 11 million of them every day. So think how many millions of dollars we're sending overseas every day. And I think that we need to look at oil imports as part of our global economic strategy, because even if we, you know, solve this problem with China and we still need a lot of it, then our trade deficit will be very negative.
Tom's on the line now from New York City. Hello, Tom. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I think it's kind of disturbing that there's such a double standard. I think the fact that China is trying to invest in the American economy is disturbing. But, for example, if it were in a European country that was trying to do the same thing, I don't think that there would be much of a fear. For example, Chrysler is no longer Chrysler. It's Daimler Chrysler, which is a German company. And no one seems to really be concerned about that. So I don't really understand why there's this double standard. It seems pretty hypocritical, and hopefully not, but maybe there's some racial undertones. I mean, why is it that if a non-European country tries to buy into America, all of a sudden it's a horrible thing, and that, you know, Congress needs to get involved? And it just seems that it's a little bit unfair, to tell you the truth.
Tom, thanks for the call, and gentlemen, I'm going to put it to you. Whoever wants to jump in on that first.
I want to comment on that, because I think this idea of racism is foolishness. That there's nothing to do with that. This is a government-controlled, government-owned corporation. This is not a commercial transaction. We in the EU, we have an enormous two-way investment and trade relationship. With China, we have an enormously different type of unbalanced economic trade and trade relationship. So that puts a different spin on what you're watching there. And people can't get sidetracked by these kinds of charges, and you need to take a realistic look at what is going on and then say, if we don't want this going on, what kind of economic policy should this country be adopting? I think it's enormously important for that to be something that Americans are talking about.
I'd like to add just a note to that, if I could. I absolutely agree with Pat Malloy that the U.S. needs to get its economic house in order. We are living beyond our means in terms of current account deficit, in terms of fiscal, just lack of fiscal discipline and so forth. But let's keep in mind also that what goes around comes around. We insisted, and the Chinese eventually agreed in the terms for joining the World Trade Organization, that they open their markets in a variety of ways, including to foreign direct investment at a level beyond which they had ever done before. American corporations invest a lot of money in China, some of that to export from China, a lot of it to sell into the Chinese market. If we now, and the Chinese investments in the U.S. are absolute chicken feed by comparison. If the Chinese begin to ramp up their investments in the U.S. and we intervene and say, no, it's a Chinese company, they have some state ownership component of that, therefore we aren't going to let them in, I think American companies are going to have a very hard time doing business in China. This is also true in the energy sector in particular. One of the biggest challenges for American energy firms globally is governments around the world blocking foreign investment in favor of their own national energy companies. Our companies rely on being able to access reserves abroad, being able to invest abroad. We don't want the U.S. government becoming one of those governments that then says no to investment by a foreign energy company in the United States. If we do that, I suspect that that's going to make it still easier for foreign governments to treat our own oil companies in the same way. So this is a world where everyone is watching what everyone else is doing, and that has to be part of the mix of factors in a final judgment on this particular deal.
Well, Galeft, what about this point that some make that, hey, it's better to make common cause with China instead of letting the competition for oil become a source of tension? Let's work together for stability in the Middle East, for example.
Well, I think it's very important that the Chinese become more engaged in those areas and cooperate with the United States. But as we see with the example of Iran and Sudan, oil has a major impact on their foreign policy decisions. We all agree that a nuclear Iran is a problem. And when the United States and the Europeans wanted to deal with this issue through the Security Council, the Chinese said that they will not allow any sanctions and they will use their veto power. The same thing happened with Sudan. So it is very difficult to separate energy security interest and national, international security issues. And I think that there is another issue that is very important, and we need to think about the future of economic policy. How do we really make sure that our companies, whether energy companies or non-energy companies, survive in this market? I mean, after all, our energy markets are not only that they're not enjoying the same backing of the government and they cannot bring on board the same level of development aid and money that the Chinese can bring on board in developing countries to secure oil deals. But our companies also have other disadvantages. They are beholden to environmental regulations. They are beholden to anti-corruption laws. And it is very difficult for them to compete when the playing field is not even. So we need to really think hard how we can allow our companies to compete without really breaking the framework of free trade and the kind of undertakings that we have received upon ourselves.
Back to our phone.
Can I add something to that?
Quickly, if you will.
Okay. The investment, China wanted in the WTO to lock our tariffs in place. Then the corporations would move investment to China. This was part of their strategy. The enormous amounts of new investment from China, the United States, and others, and the companies then make stuff and ship it back here. That's where you're running into these huge and growing current account deficits and trade deficits. So there's a difference between our investment going into China, which market it's servicing, and their investment coming here.
Back to our phone lines now to Thompson, Connecticut. We want to hear from George. Hello, George.
Good evening. Thank you for taking my call. There are two points that I'd like to just offer as an observation and leave to our experts to comment. The first is the vast resources, hydrocarbon resources in North America, and the second is the economic system that we are privileged to have here. First, we don't seem to have a problem with some companies that are owned perhaps by Venezuela and others having fully integrated distribution channels from material all the way through the retail side of for oil and gas. Most, I don't think, are aware of that. Secondly, when we think of the Athabascan tar sands, as well as the huge coal and other oil shale resources, it seems that with our technology and expertise, we can just hold those in reserves until perhaps the cheap stuff's gone. The second part is, with our existing structure, capital, investment, technology, the rule of law, political process, and the ability to transfer wealth, I would think that given a fair amount of time, perhaps a generation, we'd come out on top. I'd be curious to offer comments.
George, thanks for the comments. Anyone like to jump in on that?
I would just say that I would not be as optimistic as about the availability of energy, at least petroleum products, in North America. If you look at, for example, a lot of people are talking about tar sands. You know, the Canadians are producing 1 million barrels a day, and if everything works well, they will ramp it up to 3 million barrels a day in about 10 or 15 years. At that time, we will be consuming very close to 100 million barrels a day globally. So these are really drops in the bucket, and I would suggest that we don't really buy into all those empty promises, because oil is still a commodity that is very much needed, but we need to have you know, light crude, and going into the heavier crude will cost a lot of money and poses many, many problems, and we are seeing it already when Canada's ability to export natural gas to the United States is falling as a result of the increased production of crude from tar sands.
Well, and what about the notion, there are those who say that this debate about greater production versus greater conservation is wrong, that you need both. Do I hear agreement on that?
I'm absolutely with you on that.
Yeah, the Chinese currently consume roughly three times the amount of energy for every dollar of GDP that is consumed in the U.S. So they clearly need to focus very much on greater energy efficiency, even as they try to grow their economy.
But I would just add that one thing we can learn from the Chinese is the latest decisions that they've made with regards to fuel efficiency. In fact, fuel efficiency standards in China today are better than those in the United States in many classes of automobiles. And I think that we, before we lecture to the Chinese about their oil consumption, I think we need to take a hard look at our energy policy as Congress is deliberating the next energy bill.
Well, and in fact, could China leapfrog this whole matter of dependency on foreign oil and develop alternative sources that might be even cheaper? Might they be ahead of us in terms of going green?
The one alternative source that China has is coal. They have enormous coal reserves. Their problems are in mining it and transporting it and cleaning it. They don't have very high-quality coal, but they have coal in abundance. Otherwise, they do not have the technologies in general that would suggest that you could simply leapfrog the current energy model abroad. So I think that energy is a long-term major constraint, and the environmental side of that is an enormously difficult problem for them. They already have air pollution, suspended particulate matter per cubic meter of air that is among the world's highest. And so I think they're in deep, deep trouble in terms of developing energy in a way that's compatible with the, you know, with the overall needs of the economy and the society.
We'll have to leave it there for now. I'm sorry. We are out of time, but thank you all so much. Kenneth Lieberthal, professor of business administration and political science at the University of Michigan. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To Gal Luft, executive director of the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, thank you.
Thank you.
And also to Patrick Malloy, who joined us from Alexandria, Virginia, member of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, which looks at the national security implications of trade with China. Patrick, thank you.
Thank you very much, Gail. Appreciate it.
You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on Forums. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.